This is the Data Science Conversations podcast with Damian Deehan and Dr. Philip Diesinger. We feature cutting-edge data science and AI research from the world's leading academic minds and industry practitioners so you can expand your knowledge and grow your career. This podcast is sponsored by Data Science Talent, the data science recruitment experts. Welcome to the Data Science Conversations podcast. My name is Damian Deehan, and I'm here with my co-host once again, Philip Diesinger.
Hi, guys.
So today we're talking to Bart Moss and Claire about industry use cases for large language models. And by way of intro, Bart Moss holds both maths and physics degrees from Heidelberg University. He's been working as an AI researcher and engineer for many years at the likes of Harman International and Samsung. He has also been a guest researcher at Alexander Humboldt Institute in Berlin. Currently, Bart Moss is the head of AI at LanguageTool. They are a German software company that has a writing assistant for multilingual proofreading, grammar, and style checking, and they do that in over 30 languages. Bart Moss has a deep understanding of the maths behind AI and has been developing products in the NLP space since 2012. He works as an advisor to boards and companies, large and small, and he even has found the time to develop an open source community that he has created called Secret Sauce, where they focus mainly on voice assistants. We're delighted to have him here. Welcome to the podcast, Bart Moss.
Thank you, Damian. It's a pleasure to be here. This is actually my first time on a podcast, so I'm actually extra pumped for this.
Great. So we normally start with your own story, Bart Moss. So please do tell us, how did you go from maths and physics at Heidelberg into data science and AI?
I ask myself that all the time. Honestly, what happened was, you know, ever since I was a kid, I really wanted to be a physicist. And I did that for many years at university. I just found, honestly, that the academic life just didn't suit me, really. It just didn't fit for me. And when I started questioning what I wanted to do next, an opportunity presented itself. A colleague of mine, his father was a professor and worked with AI way back then in, I think, 2012 it was, 2013, somewhere in there. And there was this very interesting project with natural language processing dealing with automating content governance systems for banks. And purely because of nepotism, honestly, it's not what you know, sometimes it's who you know. I got involved in that and I started studying and learning about that as quickly as possible. And then I founded a company to build up the solution for, I think it was 5 or 6 different languages. And I mean, this was, you know, back in the stone ages of NLP back then. And I really discovered a great passion for this. And I just knew that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And sometimes you just get lucky like that, I guess.
And obviously you find yourself now at the cutting edge of actually using LLMs in the business world. We're obviously in the very early stages of these use cases, but you have some solid ones to talk about. So let's start there. Can you give us an overview of what you're doing at LanguageTool?
So at LanguageTool, one of the use cases we have, which of course would be the primary use case for us, would be in grammatic error correction, called GEC for short, where obviously someone writes something like a sentence or a text, and then they want their grammar checked and they want it replaced with the correct grammar. That's, of course, a very basic use case. LanguageTool has existed in itself for about 20 years, but of course they didn't use AI back then, or machine learning. As head of AI, one of the things that we wanted to do was create a general grammatic error correction system, GGEC for short, to be able to catch all kinds of errors for all languages possible and correct them. Now, that's a kind of an interesting use case, in my opinion. I mean, I also have taught English back when I was at university. I actually taught English, and I always had an interest in language, and I corrected a lot of grammar back in the day. So it really fit with what I did. And how it really works there is simply that, you know, a user first, you know, writes a text, and then, of course, our system needs to somehow be able to correct it. Now, how exactly does that work? Well, you're going to want to use a model for that. And one thing that is a very big question there is, do you use a model that exists already that's a very large model, like a large language model? something like GPT-3 or GPT-4 and just use prompting? Or do you create your own models for this? And one thing, of course, we found is that if you create your own models to do this very specifically, it's on one side cheaper, but on the other side, it's faster and it actually works better and scores better. And so we've created our own models for doing exactly this kind of task. There's a lot of questions there when it comes to business case with latency. You know, how accurate or correct do you want your system to be? There's a lot of trade-offs with, of course, what kind of resources you have to run this in production. Of course, when you run for millions of users, you have to make sure to have a good trade-off between the performance and speed and price, right? There are also a lot of discussions about, do people use encoder-decoder models, something like akin to T5 or other sequence-based models, or do you use just a decoder model? Decoder models have become very, very popular, and we've seen a lot of scaling behind decoder models, I mean, such as GPT-3, GPT-4, Llama, Llama 2, et cetera, many more coming out, it seems, every week. There's a lot of great tools for them, but sometimes the question is, you know, how big do you need a model for your purpose? And you have to benchmark that and test that to see how well that works.
Can you dive a little bit deeper to give us a better understanding of the business case? Like, who are the users? How does that work? Is it a real-time application? Is it offline, online? Like, how do we have to envision this grammar tool?
This is a real-time application that needs to work with low latency. As users are typing in a document or on a website or in any way in their browser, for example, we have an application for the desktop. There's many, many ways you can use language tool. And of course, it needs to work as quickly as possible. The use cases are completely varied in this case. I mean, it can be academics writing. It could be for business. We have both B2B and B2C customers. So it really, we don't have a one size fits all for our customers. In the end, it really varies. But one thing is for sure, we need to find a good balance for grammar correction and annoying people. That's something that's really kind of funny with these systems. You know, people just assume that it's just the grammar is either correct or not. But there are cases where we've seen that many users don't like a rule, and you look at the analytics and you think, well, it's technically correct. But if enough people don't like something, you have to debate whether you want to turn it off. And a good example of this is in English with to whom or for whom. People, a lot of times nowadays in English, just say who, and grammar changes over time, and we have to be mindful of that. Another funny use case there with that is a lot of people in Slavic languages don't use the definite and indefinite article, so the and a. You notice that they say that they don't want this rule a lot of times, suggesting an edit that puts in an indefinite or definite article, but in the end that it is correct. I hate to tell you guys, it's correct to use those articles there. We're pretty sure about that. You have to really strike a balance with your users. And I think that's something really, really important there.
How many users do you have?
We have several million users in many different languages, 6 primary languages. However, we support over 30 different languages worldwide. And we have employees from all over the world. It's a very great and diverse place to work. That's for sure.
You mentioned decoders and encoder decoders. What are the different scenarios where you might recommend one over the other?
I mean, it really depends, of course. You know, if you're starting out by maybe prototyping, maybe you want to use a very large decoder, which is very popular nowadays, using a prompt so that it has some sort of emergent behavior so that you can just do zero shot or few shot prompting. That's quite good for that. But maybe you want to do a task where, you know, you're doing something like translation, for example. And generally, it's found that sequence-to-sequence encoder-decoder models perform very good for that. And of course, you have to think of things like context window. Do you want to do large amounts of text, or do you just want to do it on a sentence level? There's a lot of things to consider here.
So how does GEC work in practice then? And what are the challenges with what you're doing?
Well, GEC in practice, of course, you have to start with some really good data. And, you know, generally you want to fine tune a model with very good data where you just have sentence pairs, perhaps, or text pairs between one that could possibly have mistakes in it and one that is completely golden. once you have, of course, fine-tuned your model, and of course, you need to check it to see if, how it's working. Now, if you would think that would be quite simple to check to see how well it's performing, but you have to remember there can be multiple grammar corrections for a sentence. So there, you have to be able to handle that. And I think that's a very interesting challenge where it's not just black and white. Other challenges, of course, things with hallucinations or extreme edits, if you want to call it that. You don't really want the output to be too far changed. You want it to be the same meaning as the original sentence. And maybe you don't want certain words changed. You just want to fix the grammar. And there's always a risk with these models that they will change much more. And there's a lot of different tools to solve these types of problems. Everything from checking edit distances with Levenstein or similarity with cosine similarity. And there's a lot of different approaches there. There's also some interesting things that I've read about with tagging edits. There's something called errant, which can be very popular, especially academically. It's very popular for tagging sentence edits that can also reduce this issue that of over-editing, of over-changing a sentence. And also, sometimes there's a question of how much do you change a sentence before you shouldn't change it anymore? The great thing about Language Tool, like I said, is it's existed for 20 years. And so there's a lot of standards and practices in there that have developed through building a rule-based system that we could inherit into doing this with artificial intelligence.
The rule-based system that you mentioned from the past, that system is still being used at the moment. So you have a hybrid system, GenAI and rule-based.
Absolutely. When it comes to really basic things that can be formulated into rules, it's very cheap and very accurate, and it works. There's no reason to fix that. It's a lot of times it's these more complex contextual-based grammar issues where, you know, you can't just create a simple rule for it because there's so many exceptions that machine learning is very ideal for that. And of course, running machine learning models with inference in production could be more expensive than just writing a simple rule with, let's say, regex or Python or whatever you would want to use.
So Bartmos, you explained that there are basically rule-based systems and you also use AI. If you have rule-based systems like based on regular expressions, so how do they work together with the AI systems?
Well, one thing you can do there is it's very important for us that we don't just correct the grammar, but we explain to the user why, you know, the rules. And every time we have a match, we also have to explain the reasoning behind that. And this means that every match has a unique rule ID. So for certain rule-based systems, you have an ID for those, and you have an ID for all of the types of matches that can occur in the machine learning aspects. And you can then prioritize those rules. For example, let's say that 9 times out of 10, there's a rule that works with rule-based system, but then it triggers for that one time where there's a deeper context. You can prioritize the AI model over the rule-based system. And it works pretty well, actually. I mean, I'm honestly sometimes so surprised we don't have endless loops we get stuck in or of correction or anything like that. We handle that pretty well.
So, Bartmos, you mentioned that you were trying to develop a generalized system, generalized GEC. How far away are you from that? Or how do people need to think about your AI system? Is it like specialized agents that all specialize in one task that they solve, and the rule-based system then uses them depending on the need? Or is it really like one generalized AI system that basically answers some of the questions?
Like I said, we do keep our legacy rules where they function very well and they always work. I mean, there's certain cases where you know something's always going to be true, like capitalizing at the beginning of a sentence or punctuation at the end and so on and so forth. You know, very basic things. But for general grammatic error correction, this is something that we worked on for a while, and we actually do have running in production. It's a quite interesting system. As I said, we do have these many, many layers in production, from rule-based systems to specific machine learning based solutions for an actual one type of correction. We call that system HydroLeo. And we also use what we call GGEC, which is the general grammatic error correction, which can solve everything. Oh, well, not everything. There's certain things you can't teach a model sometimes, and you have to do in post-processing. But, you know, I don't know. I hope I'm not giving away too many secrets here.
How much data do you need to train those models? Like, what's the role of the data? What kind of data do you use? Is it all natural data? Is it synthetic data?
In the end, it is a mixture. And I mean, we do have opt-in user data that we collect from our website. We also have golden data that we've annotated internally ourselves and from our language experts. We'd be lost without them. And so we have people for every language. We have several people who actually go through and review and annotate data for us, which is very, very, very helpful. We do also generate data, absolutely, synthetic data. And generally, when it comes to these models, you have to ask yourself, do you want to train these things in stages or do you want to train them all in one go? Is it better to use synthetic data for part of it, or should you just use fewer points of data and focus on quality? These are a lot of questions that we have to answer constantly, and I don't know how much detail I can go into there, but it's quite an interesting mixture of tasks and methods that we use there with generation, with user data, with data that we internally create and annotate. One thing that's, of course, very important that you have to watch out for is, of course, the distribution of the data. It really should be how it is for the users. And we want to keep that distribution as close to how the users actually use this as possible. And so you don't want to get too far away with your data distribution, especially with errors. I mean, there are errors that can come more often than others. Spoiler alert, for example, commas. A lot of errors there with commas. And so you can see those way more often than certain other types of errors. And you want to make sure that that distribution stays roughly the same. Otherwise, you won't have as good performing model.
Yeah, it takes me back to the very first podcast we did was with Professor Philip Cohen from Johns Hopkins University. And it was on machine translation. And he talked about the very subjective nature of language. So given that, how do you effectively benchmark the GEC and its tasks?
That's something we've had to build a lot of tools for from scratch, because that just doesn't really exist out there. And as I said, you can get something marked wrong, but it's an actual correct correction, because there are more than one ways to correct a sentence, right, or a text. And in those cases, of course, the most obvious method, which is kind of tiring sometimes, is just to collect every possible variant of a correct version of a sentence, but that's a monumentous task, and it's not always the best way to do it. There are a lot of other ways you can do this. Obviously, you need to ask yourself, what's more important? Do you want precision or recall? You know, when it comes to the users, you know, we do have some really good analytics there. I mean, we can't see what people are writing or anything like that. We are very data privacy focused. Of course, if you opt in to have your text used for machine learning purposes by us, then obviously, but generally we can't read what people are writing. That's not saved anywhere. And so we can see if a user generally applied a suggestion, or if they said no to it or just ignored it. And we guide ourselves a lot by that. I think honestly, there is no 100% silver bullet. It's just a barrage of methodologies there to ensure that we are giving our users the best possible quality corrections that, you know, they can trust, whether they're writing a thesis or a legal document. And, you know, we take that very, very seriously. And I think because we've been doing this for 20 years, I think that gives our brand a very big strength, because we have ironed out a lot of those issues.
And how do you measure the performance of your system?
Like I said, there's a lot of different measures we use for performance. Obviously, the typical, you know, F1 scores and things like that when you're training a model or fine tuning a model. You know, generally with your evaluation data set, this is, you know, something you look at. And of course, that's not 100% foolproof, because it can offer suggestions that are correct that you might not have. But that's a good rule of thumb there. Also, as I said, the user analytics, when you put something online, you can see if the users really hate it very quickly. We do partial rollouts. We do A/B tests, obviously. The standard practices that you see within companies when it comes to rolling out models, we like to release regularly and you know, start with partial rollouts and just see what our users say to it. That's, you know, a very important metric for us is from the users. We do also manual reviews, obviously. That's very also time consuming, but that's something that we find very important, is taking subsets of data and having, professional language experts review this. And that's, you know, one point that I think is quite important. These aren't just the usual data annotation folks. These people are very specialized in language, because a regular person who does data annotation is not really qualified to know exactly what's 100% grammatically correct in a language. Being a native speaker isn't enough. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a business case because people wouldn't make mistakes, right? So you have to find very, very highly qualified people to review the data who really have a very deep understanding of language.
Can you talk about the platform before LLMs and how it has improved the user experience and the performance now that you have LLMs?
There's two main use cases for us with LLMs. One, of course, is we use it for the general grammatic error correction, obviously, and we also use it for rewriting or rephrasing. In these two areas, first off, with paraphrasing, you can't really do it without these kinds of models. And it was a huge, big use case for us, and it created a lot of stickiness for us when we released this first, and we saw it was a really big hit. And that just completely changed because that's something you couldn't do really before with previous systems. And of course, with grammatical error correction, you can really catch things that you couldn't catch before. Before such models, the best we could do was train smaller, much, much smaller models on a very specific error. And it would just do that specific error of something where, you know, there's a comma missing or something like that. And you would have to think of all of those cases. And that's very similar to rule-based, where you have to literally think of each and every type of error possible. Whereas when you're training a model, you know, as long as you can just correct the output sentence, you know, correctly, it can catch a lot of things that are much deeper that you would never think about, and very deep contextual things. And you can change things with style. You can improve fluency. There's so many use cases for language, and that we can bring that into all kinds of applications. I mean, I myself use it, of course, every day, which is really nice. I get a free premium account. So I'm using it in my Slack. I'm using it in my emails. And, you know, I find myself, even though I taught English for several years, I find that I'm like, oh, I missed a comma there. And that's quite helpful. So
regarding that switch to using LLMs more, did that have an impact on your cost side? Is that a consideration?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a cost trade-off there, you know, because we do host all of our own infrastructure for this with our GPU servers. We found that, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer. You get higher retention when you find more errors and improve people's spelling and grammar. And when you do this, you do get better numbers. You get better conversion rates for premium. So it's a worthy investment for us. Of course, you know, you really have to consider these things with cost. And, you know, bringing the cost down is something that we actively do. And we've worked a lot in compressing models, accelerating models. And that's its own little niche area, you know, of these things aren't plug and play. I assumed they were. I thought we could just plug it in. And you end up pulling your hair out trying to get some framework working for compression or something that's new. And you think it should just work. And you end up building all of your own stuff and even fixing upstream bugs. And oh, my goodness, I could talk about a whole podcast just about that, I think.
I can imagine, yeah. A little bit philosophical question. So you mentioned at the beginning that language is something that's constantly changing, but now we're entering an era where LLMs and Gen AI has an impact on our language, right? It's correcting us, right? It's writing itself, right? Lots of articles and text and so on is synthetically generated. Do you think that at some point in the future, in 10 years or so, that LLMs will start having an impact on shaping language?
I think to some degree they already do. I mean, we can a lot of times detect whether a longer text is you know, generated. And I noticed a lot by playing around with certain different LLMs that they like to inject certain words all the time. And I don't know if that's for watermarking purposes or what that actually is, because a lot of times they're not very transparent about these things. But I've noticed that. And I think as we rely on them more, we will definitely see a greater impact with language. But it's always important to note that these things are just predicting the next token based on a huge amount of data from people. And so, you know, as long as you're training new models or fine-tuning new models, that'll change with the times also. You know, we might have to add in new vocabs, possibly. But otherwise, I think, you know, this thing with language is fluent. It's very fluid and it changes over time. And we have to change with it. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. And maybe one day we will remove the articles and indefinite articles in language. Who knows? I don't know. I mean, how much longer before in German there might not be a formal you, or in other languages, all of these things are constantly changing. And there's so many forms, like English words invading other languages, becoming way more global. And I think that will continue. And as long as we're able to communicate with each other effectively and beautifully, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
You mentioned that a point that I found quite interesting. So you are trying to detect basically whether text or some data has been generated by a model or whether it was generated by humans. I'm assuming you need to do that to, you know, to ensure data, you know, input data quality. How do you approach this?
We don't specifically offer this as a product, but of course, this is something that we do play with and we do check out. And I mean, one thing, the easiest way to do it is you can take an LLM and figure out, you know, what the probability is of the next word in a sequence. And if it seems too probable that the LLM would predict these words in a sequence, then it might be generated. Long story short, right?
So, and then when you find a text that seems to be have generated, then you take it out of your training data, or how does it work?
Well, for us, that's not really a consideration. I mean, whether it's generated or not is really immaterial for us. This is just something out of interest. We do a lot of different research, and we have a lot of researchers and people who have a really heavy background in research and open source at Language Tool when it comes to AI. And so we do a lot of different types of experiments. And, you know, that's some of it. And we do have partner companies we work with for a lot of these things. And, you know, we're part of a larger group company. So these are a lot of things that we consider. But for us, it's just more out of interest. What people are doing with the language and how it's used is whether it's generated or not is really immaterial to our business case. In the end, even the greatest, latest LLMs can make grammar mistakes. And I've seen that again and again. And so they're not foolproof themselves. Our job is just to make sure that we get it correct for you.
And I can't remember if you're allowed to say this or not, but you're using an open source LLM with Language Tool. You're not combining it with GPT via the API.
No, we don't use external APIs, especially for grammatic error correction. One, you know, this is a privacy concern because a lot of our users are very privacy focused, and our data generally stays within the EU. And, you know, like I said, we also don't save just any data from our users. It's only when it's opted in from the website. We don't want to pass that externally anywhere because we have a high respect for data privacy of our users, even to third parties. And so we keep that all in-house with processing, with inference, that is. And so that's something very important to us. So everything we're doing is completely built internally. And we use a variety of different types of models, and we're always experimenting with new ones.
How are you dealing with the hallucination problem when it comes to a correction that's made to and that generates an output of text?
You do see these things as problems occasionally. And like I said, there's a lot of different ways to solve this. Like I said, you can measure everything from the edit distance, like Levenstein distance. You can check things like cosine similarity to make sure you're not changing the meaning. You can look at the types of edits, you know, by doing some sort of edit typing. You can use a variety of methods, and we do use a variety of methods to ensure that these models don't just completely change an output for our users. And of course, that's something we have to filter with the data that we get. Also, you have to be careful. Maybe another word would be better, but then that's style. And we want to offer users the chance, if they want to have the style change, then they can have that. But if they just want grammar, then we'll just give them grammar. And we like to offer users a multitude of different ways of correcting. And we don't want to kind of mix it all together in one big bag of here's what you get, and we're going to change your whole sentence. And unless that's what users want, we can also offer that too.
I would like to take a brief moment to tell you about our quarterly industry magazine called The Data Scientist, and how you can get a complimentary subscription. My co-host on the podcast, Philip Diesinger, is a regular contributor, and the magazine is packed full of features from some of the industry's leading data and AI practitioners. We have articles spanning deep technical topics from across the data science and machine learning spectrum. Plus, there's careers advice and industry case studies from many of the world's leading companies. So go to datasciencetalent.co.uk/media to get your complimentary magazine subscription. And now we head back to the conversation. Switching up to the second use case, Bart Moss, can you give us the overview of how you've been using chatbots for learning simulations with HeyLlama?
HeyLlama uses LLMs as chatbots to help creators turn training material into AI simulations across a broad and diverse range of use cases. I mean, we're talking from language learning, sales, leadership, education, etc. And this is, you know, something very interesting of embracing LLMs to actually help people learn. And I mean, that's something I'm passionate about. And of course, the co-founders, Dan and Sherzad, are absolutely passionate about, because I think they've been doing this now for over 2 years. And this is a quite an interesting area. It's something that's really evolving with LLMs, that you can do this, whereas it's something you really couldn't do before. And of course, on the onset, it wasn't really focused on chatbots. It was interesting because they were creating a lot of different sort of AI-based games and other things to enable learning. But then they found that the chatbot feature was just the most sticky one. And when you're doing startups, you never know what's going to be successful. It's always a bit of a surprise to see what people actually like in the real world, right? And that's how it kind of got into more focused on chatbots based on user feedback. And it just kind of exploded. They're relying on LLMs with using either prompting or fine tuning to create simulations for users to be able to learn. And I mean, we're talking like I've used it for example, for job interview. Right. I wanted to practice for job interviews and things like that. And I started practicing and trying that out. That was an interesting use case. And I think it might have helped me get my job at Language Tool, because I did simulate with that. And that was fun back in the early days when we were still trying to figure out those features. It can simulate multiple personas. So it's not just like, you know, you're talking to the AI, but it can simulate multiple personas and, you know, different types of situations. Of course, this is something you really, you know, have to watch out for at the same time, because, of course, you can be dealing with factual information here, and LLMs can make mistakes, such as things with the reversal curse, which is something, Damon, you've brought up before, that, you know, there are cases where LLMs can just not, they're not as intelligent as we think they are. And I think that's something you have to watch out for.
Can you just quickly explain the reversal curse?
It's when you would have some sort of, I guess, easy logical conclusion that you could get. Maybe something where if A, then B, and maybe if B, then A. So it goes in, let's say, both directions. But then it's misunderstood in one direction, perhaps. And you say, well, it should work both ways. And then the model might not understand it. And so you might say, you know, A is B and B is A. And then you'll say, well, what is B? And then it will say C or something like that. I don't know maybe that's not a very good example. I don't know. Damien, do you have maybe a better example for us? Or?
Yeah, I think the example used in a recent paper is they ask the LLM, who is Tom Cruise's mother? It answers perfectly, but then it can't tell you who his mother's famous son is. So that's would be, I think, an example of that. So you mentioned prompting and fine-tuning. So maybe talk about when that's the best method versus retrieval augmented generation, RAG, and that whole interplay, and how people should decide there.
Yeah, this is a really big question. And I mean, of course, you can do all of the above, obviously. But, you know, generally, this is something where you have to test. And with retrieval augmented generation, that is any time where you would inject some sort of information into a prompt with a query to give some sort of context or information for the LLM. Now, you can do this on a really big level where you would use some sort of vector store, vector database, where you have huge amounts of data and articles and you have to match with the query to actually extract out information and then prompt that further. That's something that's very popular nowadays, especially with chatbots. And you can do that. I would say the biggest use case there is something like with open question and answering systems. You can use, you know, an API, or you can use a vector store, something like that, and try to match the user's query, and then prompt that right back in. Hey Llama is doing that to an extent. They're not actually using vector stores currently because that's not necessary. And that's another thing with businesses. You know, you don't do things just because they're cool, right? Yeah, you have to stay business focused. And they are injecting information such as what is the scenario, what is the user's name, things like that, into the prompt that they generate, they build to prompt a model. And of course, generally when it comes to fine tuning, you have to understand that you know, facts can change, things can change. And when you're fine tuning a model, if that information can change, that might not be the best course of action. You might not want to do that, but then again, maybe you want to fine tune generally on how the prompt is displayed or how it comes out, but you still want to give it slots or facts. And this is very similar, actually. It seems to be like history is repeating itself. I remember this reminds me of NLG engines back in the old days with slot filling and things like that. You know, before LLMs, this is kind of how you would handle things. You would write out, you know, text, and then you would have little slots in them that then you would dynamically fill, you know, programmatically. And it's quite similar to that. And I think, you know, the revolution, of course, is in the LLMs themselves, but the techniques that we're using are still quite similar to slot filling and natural language generation engines seen years ago. That's, I think, what it really boils down to is, what is your use case? Can you just fine tune a model? Like, obviously, with the previous business case we talked about with grammatical error correction, you can create a model or fine tune a model, or, you know, you even use something new and splashy like Laura or something like that. If you're so inclined, if you want to train such a big model and you can't fit it there. But when it comes to factual things, and especially things that can change over time, you definitely want to inject that information from some sort of API or database into your prompt.
I mean, you've talked a couple of times about LLMs and that they don't come off the shelf. There's, of course, many different ways of adjusting an LLM and making it perform better. You mentioned training it, fine-tuning, but then, of course, you can also do a lot of prompt engineering. You know, you can build agents and tools and so on. What is your practical experience in that space? What has the most impact, or what does your workflow look like? What steps the process look like to make an LLM perform on a specific problem that you have?
In so many ways, it's becoming easier and easier because there's so many tools available that just didn't exist before. And I found myself writing a lot of code and building something from scratch just to find out that there was an amazing open source tool or something out there that I didn't know about. And then someone sent me the repo and I kicked myself going, why didn't I just use that? You know, I think one of the more popular ones out there, for example, with when it comes to these kinds of things is LangChain. That's something that a lot of people are using nowadays. That's just one of them. There's a lot of other tools available out there. And I think, you know, in the end, the improvements of the LLMs themselves, whether open source, closed source, API based, et cetera, that's great. But in the end, I think it's the tools that make a difference. And we didn't see a lot of great tools back in the old days with natural language generation, obviously. Like there was some stuff from universities and you kind of had to build it all yourself. And nowadays these tools are readily available and it makes it so easy. You don't really need to go down deep level and, you know, do everything by hand anymore. And I've seen people picking up and coding their own chatbots, you know, with low code, no code solutions. And I think that's where a lot of the big boost comes from, really, and making it easy for people who maybe aren't AI researchers for many years to be able to build something and you know, just push the button and get it working.
Can you give us an overview of the downfalls of relying on the external APIs and the closed source models?
Absolutely. I mean, when it comes to, you know, using an external API, you know, it's quite easy to start off and prototype, and I think that's very good. But, you know, there are questions, of course, of data privacy, which is a big question there. What data was used on these models? You know, how were they trained? Things like bias. You don't really have as much control there when you're relying on them. And some of the biggest issues involved that I see as an advisor to companies is the latency and the cost. And I think especially cost, this is something that's greatly underestimated by companies. I see this time and time again when people hit me up for micro consulting or general advisory work is they don't really understand the cost involved, especially if you have actually a feature that's a hit. And you can see that there. And at the same time, there are, you know, a lot of user complaints on latency of this is taking too long to get a response. And you do see that quite often. A very good example of that would be actually back going back to language tool. We created a system for rewriting or rephrasing or paraphrasing. There's a lot of terms for that, but in the end, it's taking a style such as formal, and you take a sentence and you make it more formal. For example, that's a concrete example of that. And we started off using OpenAI for that, just to prototype it and see how it would work if users liked it. Because like I said, you never know what people want out there. And that's why I stay out of the product department. I'll stick to AI. I think AI is easier than product in the end, because you never know what people want. And it turns out that people really loved this rephrasing, rewriting feature, so much so that we saw a huge, huge growth in users and the usage. And, you know, we celebrated on one side, but on the other side, we were thinking, oh, the costs are going up. And sooner or later, that hit a red line, and it hit the red line a lot quicker than we expected it would. And, you know, that's when the CEO calls you up and says, well, what are we going to do about this? You're the head of AI, do something. And go, okay, I'm on it. And we realized we needed to make our own in-house models. That's the term we use, is in-house, to try to differentiate between using external APIs for LLMs. This is something that we had to, of course, develop very quickly. And we actually really found that when you get the right data, you get the right model, and you know, you get the right service for hosting this with GPUs, the cost is tremendously less. The latency is a lot less. And when you're doing really big numbers every month, it really cuts it down to almost nothing in comparison. But the craziest thing is when we benchmark this using A/B tests, we found that users preferred our models over the very large LLM models that we were using with external APIs. And we actually used several external APIs for this testing. And yeah, it seems that a lot of times if you take models and make your own models or fine-tune models, they can have a smaller number of parameters, but at the same time, they can perform better because they're very domain-specific for a task. And I think that's where most of my bread and butter comes from, is from that experience. And that's also what we are doing with Hey Llama also. And I advise a lot of companies on this. I hope I'm not giving all my secrets away and people will still give me money for this. But in the end, it's really about getting people off that addiction to external APIs that can be very costly and have a lot of latency that users complain about, to creating very, very specific models for the use case that they have. That is just like the NASA slogan of the 90s, faster, better, cheaper. And that's what we're really focused on there. And that's exactly what we're doing as an AI strategy with Hey Llama. And that's why it creates profitability for companies. Because one thing I hear a lot with companies, they want to grow their user base and they don't care about profitability and they end up spending so much money. But I think you can also be profitable at the same time if you cut down those costs. And so I think that's a big advantage to a lot of these open source models, that you can run them yourself for business use cases. Not all of them. You have to watch out for those licenses, but you can run them yourselves and you can save money. Now, of course, at the same time, a lot of these closed source ones, like I said, they're so much easier to use. And I highly recommend it for rapid prototyping and seeing what would be sticky with your users. I think that's a great use case. But in the end, you know, it's a question of time and money.
Sorry, you were originally using GPT-3 then?
Yes, we were using GPT-3 originally when that came out back then, and what we were using originally for this service. And of course, we also had to create a special agreement with our users for this feature to opt in, because we were passing that data to a third party, and you know, that was a consideration for us. And I mean, in the end, we also used a lot of other resources available there. We used a company also called Aleph Alpha, and we worked with them. And we also, when GPT-4 came out, we tried, you know, using that also for the same use case. We did fine tuning with GPT-3, because a lot of people I seem to overlook that you can also fine tune those models, and you don't just need to do prompting with them. And a lot of different types of tests, a lot of different things we tried out there. But in the end, we found that our models in-house actually work better for both for users and also for our internal tests that were double blind with our language experts.
And would you say that the cost differential from OpenAI's models to your own model is what, 10 to 1, 5 to 1?
Oh gosh, it's massive. It's massive. It's, I mean, honestly, with our users, the way they were using this feature so heavily and how many more users kept signing on to it, it would have just been a matter of time before the company wouldn't have been able to pay for that anymore, I think, honestly. And I would say, let's say something like 10 to 1, maybe.
But what you mentioned already, that reducing parameter space is key. How about reducing the amount of training data? Is that something that you guys tried out? Like shifting to more high quality data, but to less training data? Yeah.
Absolutely. You do have to have a balance there. And I mean, it's similar to what we talked about with our first business case of general grammatic error correction. You know, it's always about the quality of the data. But, you know, with rephrasing, it's a bit trickier because, you know, what is more formal? What is less formal? You know, how do you define formality of a sentence? How do you define whether a sentence is simpler or you know, any sort of style? That can be quite subjective. And, you know, it's hard to get an agreement between people about sentence formality. And so in the end, it's really, really heavily based on user acceptance and A/B testing of a large swath of users. We do, of course, internally check these things out. But in the end, yeah, it's quite hard to measure these things.
Makes sense, huh?
So, Bart Moss, before we wrap up, do you want to quickly give an overview of your open source community?
I'd love to. This is, you know, a big passion for me. And I mean, we all do this in our free time. You know, this isn't like a work thing for us. At Secret Sauce AI, we've been doing that for, I guess a couple of years now. And, you know, we're mainly focused on voice assistants, but any type of AI. And we really focus on trying to help open source developers understand and use NLP and create tools for them to better use NLP in their own open source projects. We are a conglomerate of many different projects. There's, of course, Mycroft, which I think is the biggest one. We have a lot of people from the Mycroft community. I'd actually love to give a special shout out to Jarvis AI. He's kind of the heart of that community. There's Open Voice OS, which is connected to that. There's Leon AI, Sapphire, Athena, Lily, a lot of different little projects out there. And we all kind of come together and, you know, just hack it out and whenever we have time. And unfortunately, we don't have always so much time, but we squeeze in our time here and there to work on our different open source projects. And if anyone is ever interested in doing a collaboration, you can reach out to me. And we always welcome that, you know, whether it's ASR, NLG, NLU, TTS, even computer, you know, vision generation, you know, generation of images or computer vision, things like that. We work in all kinds of areas, and we love to teach people and build tools to support the open source community to further that.
Awesome. And we will put the links for that into the show notes. So sadly, that concludes today's episode. Just before we leave you, I want to quickly mention our magazine, The Data Scientist. We will feature a version of this conversation as an article in a forthcoming issue of the magazine. The magazine is packed full of articles detailing what some of the world's most successful companies are doing in relation to data and AI, and you can subscribe for free at datasciencetalent.co.uk/media. So, Bart Moss, thank you so much for joining us today. It was an absolute pleasure, and it was an amazing conversation.
The pleasure is all on this side, Damien and Philip. Thank you so much for inviting me and having me here today.
And thank you, Philip. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Do check out our other episodes at datascienceconversations.com, and we look forward to having you with us on the next show.